Hello.
Oz Garibovitsagi. Hello. Hello. Is this Melissa?
This is Melissa Coffin at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production and the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council. And this is the quarterly webinar of the GC3. And today's topic is a presentation on California's draft regulations for safer consumer products and their implications for green chemistry. And our speaker today is the acting director of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. And Joel Pickner is on the phone. I'm going to ask Joel to introduce our speaker today.
Thank you, Melissa, and welcome everyone to the call. I think it speaks highly for the efforts of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control that its acting director, Mazyar Movasagi, is on the phone today to give the presentation. I think, as many of you know, or all of us know, California is embarking on an initiative to advance safer chemicals in the state that is unprecedented in the world, and its new draft regulations on safer chemicals or alternatives assessment is a big first leap into a state regulating products. California certainly has plenty of experience through Prop 65 and other initiatives, but this is taking that to a much higher level. And I think the question that many companies have is, how is this going to affect them, and how are they going to comply with the very detailed obligations that they have under this act. Director Movasagi was appointed as acting director in 2009. Prior to that, he was the deputy director of the Brownfields and Environmental Restoration Program at DTSC. And prior to DTSC, he worked in the private sector, focusing on financing and development work across the country. He has served as assistant development director and assistant to Mayor Jerry Brown, and has worked quite a bit in brownfields restoration, and prior to that he was the California Wetlands Program Coordinator. He is a graduate of UCLA and the Goldman School at UC Berkeley, and we're very pleased to have you, Director Movasagi.
Thank you, Joel, and hello to everyone on this group. I'm very excited to be able to share updates about our Green Chemistry Initiative, because our ultimate goal of getting to that world of benign by design products is going to happen with the innovation and ingenuity of many of you on this call. So in our effort to be transparent and engage in this dialogue, I am truly excited to be before this group. I wanted to obviously spend most of the time talking about our regulatory proposal and some of the thinking behind it, but I'd like to set it in context of what the broader Green Chemistry Initiative is. So with that, I'll get the presentation started. I apologize for this mumbo-jumbo. We're trying to be cute with the graphics. But you all very well know that our ultimate goal is sustainability, and life cycle thinking is one subset of actions we can take to get to sustainability. And for us, we put the Green Chemistry Initiative within this bubble of life cycle thinking. The initiative has six different planks. And today, when I talk about our Safer Consumer Product Alternatives Regulation, I'm going to be mainly talking about plank number 5, and that was to accelerate the quest for safer products. However, I want everybody on this call to know that the department is working on many of the other recommendations that you see on your screen. And if any of you are interested, for instance, in getting into a public-private partnership with DTSC to look at a particular type of product or chemical, we have a call out for that. For folks who are in the education arena, we're constantly looking for different pedagogical tools for training folks to be knowledgeable about green chemistry, and also folks that have an IT background. One of the issues we got to solve is how to get data to move from a supply chain to retailers, manufacturers, and all the way down to consumers and regulators as well. So those calls are out. This is a wonderful time to be able to do some of these partnerships because we have more questions to answer than we have solutions for, and there's a good amount of receptivity here in Sacramento for new ideas right now. This window will close. It won't be open forever. It will close because the demand for dealing with consumer products is increasing. Last year in California, we had upwards of 24 bills related to specific chemical ad hoc ban bills. That pressure is going to be increasing in the coming legislative cycle as well. So if anybody has ideas, we purposely are leaving these very open in the sense that we recognize there's different ways to do public-private partnerships or demonstration projects. For instance, in the short term, we're also in the process of developing alternative assessment case studies. So if anybody wants to be a part of that dialogue, we very much welcome it, and either through Joel or others, if you could get a hold of me, I'd make sure that I'll put you in touch with the right folks in DTSC. So now, to the presentation on hand. Our regulatory proposal really has three main sections. We're first going to prioritize chemicals and products. Then we're going to ask for manufacturers, importers, suppliers of those prioritized products to complete an alternatives assessment. And then we're going to assign a regulatory response based on the alternative selected and identified. So how are we going to get started? We're first going to prioritize chemicals. Chemicals can come into our prioritization scheme if they meet a hazard endpoint identified by our sister department, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OHEA. As you all are probably aware, they are in the process of developing their own regulatory proposal. They've had some informal workshops, I believe they will be probably showing or moving to the formal rulemaking process with their proposal as well. But so if you have a chemical that hasn't a hazard trait on that list, you're eligible to come into our prioritization mechanism. In our prioritization mechanism, we're going to use these six decision diamonds you see here as balancing factors to see what chemicals we need to prioritize. Our goal really here is to build on traditional risk assessment and look at other proxy data if we have data gaps. For instance, we're going to look at volume in addition to toxicity. We're going to look at if the chemical has particular effects on sensitive subpopulations or if it has specific impacts to the environment. And we're also going to look at what other regulatory and health and safety mechanisms cover that regulation. The idea here is to use a balancing criteria and identify which chemicals become our priority chemicals. These are the chemicals with the most amount of information out there and a good amount of consensus, maybe not full consensus, but a good amount of consensus that, you know, they are the bad of the bad. We might also identify chemicals that fall under the chemicals under consideration. These are chemicals that exhibit some of the concerns we're talking about, but there might not be full consensus on them. But we view them as being on the on-deck circle, whereas the priority chemicals move forward, the chemicals under consideration will be studied more before they move forward. We will put out a draft document that says what these chemicals are in each one of these categories, what our rationale and thinking is, and at this stage we will make available to anybody who has those chemicals an ability to do a qualitative alternative assessment. In our regs, for instance, we've pointed to the green screen as a tool. It doesn't have to be the only tool, but it's a tool that's acceptable to see if we can quickly identify if there are safer alternatives. This path is still a voluntary path until we prioritize products. So once we've finalized the chemical list, the priority chemicals and the chemical under consideration list, we will then prioritize products. Now, you notice graphically there's a little bit of overlap. We recognize in collecting information about where chemicals are, we're going to get information about products as well. But we're going to look at consumer products to use, again, these five decision diamonds to balance out and identify which priority products have to go through the process first. We're going to look at mainly here, again, exposure. Where is that chemical of concern in the product? Who uses that product? What do they use it for? How long do they use it for? One point I'd really like to point out here is this is one place where, as government, when we talk about that closed-loop, cradle-to-cradle life cycle thinking, for us, it's the loop goes all the way through end of life and disposal as well. So we're not just going to be looking at how the consumer uses it and what are potential exposures. We're also going to look at end of life exposures as well. Both both of these lists get prioritized after we put out draft documents that provide our rationale, where we drew our data from, and what chemicals and products go under each category. Folks will have an option to comment on these lists before they're finalized to make sure we have the right data, the right thinking, and the right approach. We also have made available a petition process for other public agencies, research groups, others to provide us a petition to consider either a chemical or a product. Now, admittedly, the petition process, we would need the type of information that I just talked about in order for us to be able to put that petition into play. If we have to go gather information, it puts the petition, you know, further back in the queue, but we've allowed for that process. But the key point is at the end of the prioritization process, only the priority products will continue to move through the regulatory process. The products under consideration will still have a priority chemical in them, but again, similar to chemicals under consideration, they're there to notify manufacturers that, hey, you're on the on-deck circle. You have a very good likelihood, not 100% guarantee, but you have a good likelihood of moving into the priority product category. We believe this multi-layer process mirrors some of the other regulatory programs out there, like REACH, where they have the chemicals of concern and chemicals in consideration between what REACH, what the national and the sub the national level folks do. In addition, this process allows for some time for firms to adapt and collect information about their products if they haven't done so. But at the end of the prioritization process, the department will list the list of priority products on our website. We will notify manufacturers, but those importers, manufacturers, suppliers of those priority products will have to do an alternative assessment. This brings our prioritization portion to an end, and this begins our alternative assessment section. Once your product has been prioritized, a manufacturer really has two choices. You can either submit an existing alternative assessment report to us. This is something that might have been done by you in-house, or it's done through a public source, say a university has it available. You can either submit that to DTSC, or you can submit an alternative assessment work plan that identifies, you know, what you're going to be looking at, you know, what's your product, where is that chemical in there, what are you going to be looking at, and you have 180 days to submit that work plan to DTSC. DTSC will approve that work plan to make sure that, you know, the manufacturer knows the regulatory requirements and can move through the process. Either way, the next step really is a tiered alternative assessment approach. If the first tier up here, tier one, was this qualitative green screen type approach where it's really qualitative, you know, we use available data to just break chemicals roughly into, you know, green, yellow, red list, acceptable, not acceptable type approaches, these second tiers involve two steps. First, the manufacturer will have to conduct a chemical hazard assessment and then an exposure potential assessment. They can submit. They will submit that report to DTSC. DTSC will evaluate it and respond. After that, a multimedia lifecycle evaluation will be completed of the alternatives that remain in play. The goal here really was to speed up the alternative assessment process so you don't have to do cumbersome multimedia lifecycle analysis on every possible alternative. As you move through these different tiers, we're going to knock off alternatives and narrow and focus the process. Again, it allows us to speed up the process, allows businesses to have targets to hit as they move through the regulatory proposal. The manufacturer then submits an alternative assessment report to us. These reports need to be verified by neutral third-party entities. And our regulatory proposal has a language about how we're going to certify lead assessors. These lead assessors, this is an LEAD assessor, not an LEED assessor. The idea here being that we want some guarantees that the folks who are leading this effort, whether they're in-house or out-of-house, have a good understanding of what the regulatory requirement is. They're on top of the science out there. In essence, they put the right meets and bounds on the alternatives assessment. The third-party verifier is a way for a QA/QC to ensure that by the time the reports come to DTSC, there is quality assurance and quality control work being done to limit the burden on DTSC. And also, this is a recognition to the fact that a lot of what will be done in an AA will be under the protection of confidential business information. We recognize businesses need some time to recoup the investment into alternatives and the R&D into some of this work, and we recognize that, you know, we won't be able to share that with the public at large. This is a mechanism to ensure that there's quality work being done for all parties. Once DTSC receives these alternative assessment reports completed by and verified by third-party verifiers, we will assign a regulatory response based on what the chosen alternative is. In our proposal, we've laid a couple of different paths. We've, for instance, identified what happens when a manufacturer switches to a chemical that exhibits no hazard traits. You know, that's the no further action type approach. Or if a manufacturer comes back in and says, there is no alternative to my priority chemical, we've laid out, for instance, what are the take-back requirements and, you know, extended producer require guidelines that will be imposed. You will notice that we have dashed lines that come out of these final AA reports that feed into our prioritization process. The goal really here is that we're not going to specify what alternatives a manufacturer must pick. The idea here is to set the performance target of improving on the baseline condition of the priority chemical, and then using the data about alternatives, because most of these alternatives we believe will be incremental improvements over existing priority chemicals, to feed that information back into our prioritization process. To build an incentive for manufacturers to pick the alternative that makes the most amount of improvement over the chemical of concern, but recognizing sometimes, you know, that big leap will not be feasible, it allows manufacturers to move through the process, identify what the current limits of science and technology are, but given what we know about potential impacts from the safer alternative, we might be looking at the chosen alternative someplace down the road, based on what we know again about the chosen alternative. DTSC will post the results of the regulatory responses on our website. Again, we're cognizant we have to protect confidential business information. We've also provided a tool. You'll notice this dark green box up here in the regulatory response. We've provided an option for discretionary approaches, a case-by-case approach, for a regulatory response if a manufacturer chooses us to look at the unique circumstances of a chemical or product. And those will go through our regular permitting process, if you can imagine, where we have, you know, public noticing and there's going to be public comment before the department finalizes our regulatory proposals. That, very quickly, folks, is a quick snapshot of what our proposal that's out for public comment is out there. And I think it would be better if I leave some time for Q&A, so I'll stop right now.
Great, thank you. Can I ask, is Drummond Lawson on the line?
Yeah, I am.
Great, Drummond, I know you have just a short amount of time, but I wasn't sure if you had any reactions to the presentation.
Actually, I cut about the last half of it, so probably not qualified to comment on it.
Okay, great. Anyone on the phone? I know this is a lot to absorb, but any questions on the line?
Well, I think some of us had difficulty reading the text when we were in the full screen mode, and even with it there, I cannot read the font. Are these slides available?
I will upload them following the presentation, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, but if you go to the DTSC website, dtsc.ca.gov, under our Green Chemistry tab, you will have this flowchart in addition to the regulatory text, FAQs, and I also encourage folks, and I know this is a little bureaucratic weeds, but there is a document called the Initial Statement of Reason, ISOR, that also outlines some of the logic I put out in my presentation. It's a little weedy, but I encourage folks to read that as well. Those are all available on our website.
Melissa, this is Ken Zarker from Washington State. Thanks for hosting this. One of the things that caught me was a mention of the green screen methodology, and we're looking at that in Washington State as well. And could maybe you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. This first tiered qualitative alternatives assessment, we were really hoping to give tools to progressive companies or really forward-looking companies that want to avoid ever being captured by this regulatory process, to have a tool to say, hey, the state is identifying chemicals of consideration or priority chemicals here. Are there any safe alternatives out there? And we believe that green screen is a tested tool that can really work for a good number of products, but we also recognize there might be some potential limitations, especially if you're talking assembled goods and such. So the green screen is just provided as an example of a tool that will pass muster for our regulatory proposal. But in our language and the regulations, for instance, we've made it clear we're using wording such as green screen or equivalent. So if there are other tools out there, and we know some of the bigger manufacturers have some of their own in-house tools, those will qualify as well. But the idea was, without having to do a very complicated, detailed, quantitative-oriented alternative assessment or life cycle analysis, is there a tool that can quickly identify, those low-hanging fruits?
And is that the tool that was developed based on the Design for Environment program and Clean Production Actions methodology?
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Other questions?
Hi, yeah, this is Alex. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm calling about applications, maybe not on the consumer side, but on the industrial products, specifically aerospace, where we have like contracts with the government that relate to mil specs and that sort of thing. Can you comment about the application of your regulation in that regard?
Okay, good question. The underlying statute for this regulation by purpose has a very broad definition of consumer product, and I believe a lot of folks have similar questions about, well, potentially by definition of consumer product, my specific product can get captured. So we've received similar questions. When I talked about the prioritization proposal, our intent with using these balancing criteria is to really capture the items that are true consumer products in the sense that they are in our kitchen sinks, in our laundry rooms, in our bathrooms, in our children's rooms, in our daycare facilities, nursing care facilities, and those kinds of consumer products. And recognizing that a vast majority of those products are not looked at, for their entire life cycle by any regulatory agency, I can assure you that even if we were fully funded to the teeth, this proposal will not be looking at, aerospace products, satellites, R&D type things. That being said, I do think what this proposal is trying to put out is a clear incentive for manufacturers to begin to ask in detail from their suppliers about what's in their products. Those manufacturers that will take this a progressive approach will be always far ahead of anything we would do in our regulatory proposal, because you will know what's in your products. Even if we're putting stuff under consideration category, you will have ample time to deal with it, even if it gets there. So I encourage folks to say, I really don't think any aerospace is going to be captured. We don't envision kids, licking and touching a huge amount of aerospace materials on a regular basis. But I do encourage folks to spend the time now to engage their supply chain. And we have a lot of good examples. The auto folks know what's in their products. You have retailers like, the Walmarts of the world. They're asking for information about the manufacturers who put stuff in their stores. A lot of the IT companies have set up databases where they're asking for this information. So if you don't have this kind of a database, I really encourage you to look at some of these other tools out there. Sometimes you don't even have to reinvent the wheel. I think there's efficiencies to be gained by trying to build on existing infrastructures out there.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're doing all this stuff, and we're really trying to green our entire supply chain. I would just point out that the law of unintended consequences is that sometimes things that are substitutes in one industry and they seem to work very well, they don't necessarily work in other industries. And it's, you know, if your Dell computer fails after, you know, 3 years of use, you know, it's perfectly fine. You just buy another one, and Dell's happy with that. But, you know, if your avionics fail, that's another story. So in terms of public safety, there's a lot to balance.
You bring up a very good point. That's why in our prioritization process, you'll note that we're not just prioritizing chemicals. We're actually really focusing on products at the end of that prioritization process for the very issue that you mentioned. Looking at chemicals just by themselves really doesn't lend itself to an alternatives assessment. You got to look at the chemical in the product to be able to look at what are safer alternatives based on the functionality and the requirements and such of the product.
Right.
And that's why we view ourselves as different than, you know, some of the discussion around Tusca, for instance, because Tusca reform is still focusing around the chemical and not so much the product.
Yeah, because there are, you know, just specific examples, and anybody who, you know, is working this, I know up in Washington State, I heard you had a viewer, you probably have somebody from Boeing, they're probably pretty familiar with this, that there's specific examples where trying to use a less toxic material results in a product that just does not have the life cycle reliability that, you know, the other older product, you know, does and has 50 years of, you know, proven knowledge about. And replacing that is, you know, you need new material science, new physics. It's not just a matter of, you know, gee, well, use something else. It's actually a very, very challenging problem. So good to hear that it's not going to be covered immediately. We can all still keep flying on airplanes and that sort of thing and go from there.
But, you know, let me bring in an analogy from the IT world. If we really have a good understanding about what's where in our products and we engage in a dialogue, we can avoid what I think was one of the unintended consequences of REACH, for instance, focusing on lead solder. Now, I'm not talking about the politics here. I'm just talking about the basic facts. When we've looked at lead solder and IT products, they comprise a very small portion of lead in, you know, the total package, whereas, you know, there was, you know, grams and kilograms of lead in CRTs that we've been able to take out through other means as well. So getting an idea of what's in our products is the goal of this prioritization process. So we might pick a chemical that on the toxicity scale might not be the worst of the worst, but it's so ubiquitous in so many different consumer products that would warrant action on our part because of its ubiquity. And we believe then, you know, you can have a smaller number of chemicals in a handful of number of products that have huge impacts across, you know, society as a whole.
Yeah, well, we look at this from the standpoint that if we can replace, then we will. But if we can't, and you know, meet our customers' requirements, which are brutal requirements, you know, then we have to go and look at you know, the entire value chain, end of life, disposition, and what do we do with all this stuff? And I think we're ready, willing, and able to make sure that gets all done, you know, properly. I've looked into this myself just recently at great depth, and I can tell you that it's not easy, some of this stuff, and there are unintended consequences to some of this that you know, are yet to be fully elucidated.
Well, I got to say, I guess I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but we have exactly the same goals in mind, and that's why the goal here in that middle portion of our proposal, the alternatives assessment, is to look at those unintended consequences to make sure that, you know, we're not dealing with regrettable substitutes and, you know, dealing with one short-term problem and sacrificing a long-term issue, because this legislation got passed in California to a large degree because of regrettable substitutes in California, you know, MTBE being the,
right,
you know, the mother load, right, of all examples. So that's exactly the point where we want to capture some of these regrettable substitutes.
Yeah, understood. We're all on the same page here, but you do want your pacemaker to work.
Oh, yeah.
Other questions today?
Yes, this is Connie DeFord. Can you speak to how the agency is looking at de minimis and kind of lowest levels and how you'll be evaluating that at, with respect to priority chemicals in products?
Sure. In our latest revised proposal, we still start at 0.1% de minimis by weight in, and if it's an assembled good, we're talking by weight in the component. So that's an important point I want to emphasize here. Some folks thought that when we say 0.1% by weight, for instance, we mean 0.1% in the entire assembled good. So that's not the case. It's at the component level. But if there is a regulatory threshold that's identified in our regulations, you know, for instance, public health goals, minimum content levels here in the state of California, or other US EPA tools, if a chemical has a lower regulatory threshold, then instead of, we will start at the 0.1% and go down to that level. So for instance, you know, lead, the number will be much, much, much lower. And then we've also recognized that in order to make sure that we capture aggregation of the same chemical across different products, if the same chemical is used at below 0.1% levels across multiple products, we also have reserved the right to not allow for de minimis exemptions in the aggregation issue. So we basically start at 0.1 and can work our way down.
So just to maybe add on a question there, when you talk about using regulatory thresholds, will it be in your evaluation of what's the potential exposure when that material's used in the intended fashion, or actually using, applying that to the limit in the product or in the component?
The exemption comes in a couple of different places in the sense that we prioritize the chemical you know, the concept of what the de minimis level based on the threshold discussion gets identified at that chemical prioritization part. The exemption issue comes in at the product level. The idea here was to see if, for instance, if you have different sets of manufacturers that use different amounts of this priority chemical per se, that, you know, we will go deal with manufacturers that use the most amount of the chemical. If somebody's just using de minimis level, then, you know, we will say, okay, you're exempted for now. We're looking at the big users. If everybody's at a de minimis level, that's where I was saying we're looking at aggregation issues to say, hey, does it make sense to, you know, look at, you know, a broader set of consumer product types? And that's where exposure comes in to deal with it. Exposure comes in at multiple places in this process because we're basically managing risk by saying risk is a combination of hazard plus exposure. So you have a very high bar of no possible exposure at the gate of the prioritization process. And I know no exposure means a lot. This is a place where we, for instance, wanted to exclude an R&D class 1 facility that has numbers of checks and balances and instruments of making sure that the chemical is not released into the environment. You know, it's something that's used, for instance, in an oncology research center. Then there's other exposure avenues considered in the chemical prioritization process, and then another layer of exposure viewed in the product prioritization process, and then also the exposure potential assessment in the alternative assessment. So exposure is looked at constantly, and depending on where it's looked at in the process, it has different applications.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can understand that, you know, desire to look at, perhaps look at below 0.1%, but I think it's important to note sometimes you can have very low residual levels that may still be above a regulatory threshold, but really may not be available for exposure to people or the environment, depending upon, you know, how that material is used. So just, you know, looking at the scope of materials that could be brought in and ensuring that the agency is, you know, focused on those materials that most deserve their attention.
Yeah, let me see if I capture this, because this comes about at a couple of different places as well. You all will notice that there is no minimum data set requirement in our proposal. In general, for instance, we really made the policy call that a minimum data set is too inefficient, because, you know, exposure and exposure routes are key for us. So, for instance, if we know something is a respiratory irritant, we're going to be looking at those exposure pathways, unless there's scientific evidence that there's other, you know, environmental exposures that happen in different types of media or whatever that would have to be considered. So you're right, we have to look at what was that regulatory threshold set for, you know, was it for maybe for drinking water standards, and does it have, you know, aquatic issues and human health digestion issues, or was it set as an emission level? And yes, we got to look at where it makes sense. But all stakeholders during during the summer inputs, one of the common themes was this call for an ability to take a chemical by chemical approach to de minimis, to account for all these variations. So our proposal was aimed at giving us the tools to be able to look at it on a chemical by chemical basis.
Okay, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't make a request for exemption based on de minimis, even though your level was above a regulatory threshold, if the regulatory threshold really didn't apply to the particular, you know, potential exposure that would occur. I mean, so one could put forward that as a part of an exemption.
Yes. Now, okay. I got to tell you, that's going to be scrutinized in a detailed kind of a way, because we would have to justify and be able to make a cogent argument why this regulatory threshold doesn't apply. There's definitely ways, as you pointed out, there's ways to develop that argument, but it would have to be a very tight argument with data, and we would appreciate, you know, getting help from manufacturers and, you know, whatever data they have.
And I can understand that. I guess, again, my point is that I think that there's lots of things that can be focused in on. Some of this is probably less worthy of attention than in others, and just looking at the fact that you could end up having a much longer list of, you know, materials depending upon how it was interpreted. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One other question, kind of going back to scope, and I understand that the focus is mostly business to consumer versus business to business, but will the agency be looking at products that are used by professionals, you know, like professional painters and installers? Will that be a part of the scope, or will that be less priority than products that go directly into the homes?
Yes, the underlying statute for this regulation was clear in its intent that, worker exposure issues are to be considered. In developing our proposal, we recognized that there are many existing regulatory programs, health and safety programs that operate in that business-to-business realm, whether you're talking OSHAs of the world or even, you know, our own existing hazardous waste storage transportation requirements and such for quantity generators. In addition, there's professional training requirements that are in place for many folks in the, in industrial settings. So we've expressly made intermediate products a lower priority in our prioritization process. We've also tried to include language to make it very clear that if a product is solely brought in as an intermediate product but is not existent in the final consumer product, that, you know, we don't intend to look at those either, because again, our focus is at that end consumer product category. But this is one of those places where businesses have much to gain by getting into a partnership or talking about what they do currently to deal with some worker exposure issues, because this is a little bit of a trust deficit. We've seen a lot of great examples from companies. You know, this is important to their bottom line. You know, heck, a lot of companies have a qualified, skilled workforce that they can't afford being out on sick days. But sometimes this work is not talked about, and it's created this pressure for the regulators to step in and do a lot more than I think might be needed in this arena. I got to tell you, though, when we look at how we define sensitive subpopulations, pregnant women definitely fall in that category. So you can imagine there are some segments of our economy that are employ a disproportionate amount of women of childbearing age. And when we're looking at data about products that are used in those fields, they will be prioritized higher. For instance, we have solid data to show in California that more than 75 to 80% of the employees in nail salons are women of childbearing age. We also had some data from the Bay Area that showed that close to 35 to 40% of workers, these workers work well into the end of their third trimester at these facilities. So products that are in those businesses will be looked at in our prioritization process.
Okay, so they're products used in professional sense, so business to business are included, and where they end up from a prioritization standpoint really depends upon the type of workforce, type of potential for exposure. So they're considered, as we look at the consumer product definition, it's fairly broad to include professional products, but the degree of priority really depends upon a variety of factors, one of those including sensitive subpopulations. Is that correct?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Topher Buck from Green Blue. Dr. Mavasagi, thank you very much for your presentation. I had a couple of questions I think are fairly closely related. I'd love it if you'd talk just a little bit about the third-party verification, specifically, if you have any clear sense at this point of how you are going to go about selecting or identifying or approving organizations to play that role. And the related question I'll just ask you right now is I'd love to hear you say something about how you see the Cradle to Cradle Products Innovation Institute fitting into this whole scheme. It seems like I assume that nobody thinks it's coincidence that Bill and Michael chose to launch that in California at this time.
All right, good questions. As far as the third-party verifiers, let me take a minute to talk about the three bubbles in our chart because they're related to each other. We've laid out in the same section of our regulatory proposal a process of how we're going to qualify in-house entities in case a manufacturer wishes to do the alternative assessment work in-house. And the idea really here is because we're going to be coming in and auditing alternative assessments, for us to have some guarantees that, there's a proper record keeping of who does what and what happens when. So when we come in audit, that there is a paper trail. And we also want some confidence that, the folks leading the alternative assessment have a good understanding of the alternatives out there to place the appropriate meets and bounds. In addition to the qualified in-house entities, then we're going to do these lead certified individuals. The lead certified individuals, they can use a certificate in two different ways. One is they can be the lead entity, basically the super project manager, and get hired to do the work by a manufacturer. They can be part of an in-house team, for instance. If they're not engaged in any of those activities, that same certificate allows you to be a third-party verifier to review an alternative assessment that you didn't have part in developing, but just reviewing to make sure, the right meets and bounds are right there, the right methodology, tools, and such were used to verify the work before it even comes to DTSC, as I mentioned, for QA/QC purposes. Now, in our proposal, we've laid out an accreditation model where DTSC will accreditate other entities to give out these certificates. We've been approached by academic institutions that have shown an interest to get into this arena. We've been approached by some of the folks that are, I would consider, traditional third-party entities like Underwriters Labs. We've also been approached by folks such as the Cradle to Cradle Innovation Institute because they were interested in, certifying and training individuals as well. So we've gotten a lot of interest and getting input from folks about how to design this third-party entities. But as far as us picking or selecting somebody, we really envision when this thing rolls out, we might have different type of accredited entities for maybe different parts of the economy. You could have formulated good and assembled goods kind of going into different tracks. So you could envision maybe IT folks going in a different track than car folks, than formulated goods. So we don't have any particular goals here in mind. The idea here being that we just want to make sure that it's an entity that we know has an approved teaching methodology. They have a capacity to teach folks. and really want to rely on, you know, for instance, the public accountants out there. You know, a CPA is not regulated by government. That's a full non-governmental entity that even actually doesn't have any regulations underpinning it. So there are some models out there where you can have these, certified entities and, you know, the auditing and the self-controls that go into those parties. So I hope I answered the questions. I know they're very general, but it's really, the door is wide open. If anybody wants to get into this arena, we welcome you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Maybe a further question, kind of up front, you talked about the qualitative assessment, this Tier 1 assessment. If a manufacturer, formulator, seller of consumer products identifies a chemical that's under consideration, a priority chemical in the product, if they go through and do this qualitative assessment, is that viewed to be a means to, and they make a determination to replace such chemicals? Are they required to get third-party verification, or can you just explain a bit more about that process?
Sure. That first tier, before we prioritize products, is a full voluntary path. The idea was we didn't want, businesses to have to necessarily move at the pace of government. We wanted to motivate and encourage and incentivize those progressive companies to try to take action. The idea is, yeah, manufacturer, supplier, importer can voluntarily use those qualitative tools. If they're able to identify an alternative that they want to implement, they would then have to go to a third-party entity and come to DTSC to get the stamp of approval. The idea here is, if we haven't prioritized your product, we want to create a wall of fame and recognize companies that take this voluntary action and reward them for switching to a safer alternative. The one mandatory requirement for all is that when the department lists chemicals of concern here, that there's a notification requirement to DTSC. Going back to one of the earlier questions about, you know, unintended consequences, we wanted to make sure we have a mechanism to capture manufacturers switching out of a chemical once we list it, and make sure that, you know, we don't have a stampede from a known problem to a significant unknown problem here. So there's a notification requirement to DTSC, but that dashed line is a voluntary until we prioritize the product itself. And if we prioritize the product, that qualitative assessment, unless, you know, it really can quickly point you to a super clean alternative with no hazard endpoints, which our understanding is that, you know, that's going to be a smaller portion of end outcomes, that you can use that just tier one alternative assessment to move through the regulatory process. In most instances, that first tier is going to allow you to knock off a whole bunch of alternatives, and if you have to do the alternative assessment because your product has been prioritized, that you will still have to do the second tier assessment as well, but on a smaller set of alternatives in a more manageable format.
Okay. Just another question. Kind of up front, there's a long listing of hazard traits that will be evaluated for the agency to make a determination on for chemicals under consideration and priority chemicals. Has the agency, did you consider kind of defining some weighting factor or looking at those hazard traits that are more or less important? I know you talked about the fact that decided a minimum data set wasn't efficient, and I can understand that, but did the agency give some consideration to looking at how you might weight those factors given the long list of factors to consider?
That's a great question. The focus of our prioritization is not just the chemical, but it's that chemical in the product. So, you know, the weighting factor for us here is really trying to identify where we think these chemicals are in the sense of what products they're in. As I mentioned, our goal is to capture those consumer products that are most prevalent and are used most prevalently by sensitive subpopulations. So we will pick a chemical that might not necessarily, for instance, be high on the toxicity factor might not be, you know, high on, you know, environmental impact, but we know is present at substantial volumes in products that are used by those sensitive subpopulations. The idea here is we're going to put out our chemical prioritization document, our chemical list, out for public review, and in that document we're going to outline what our justification was for pulling what chemicals into what list, because as you all will appreciate, this regulatory process aims to be scientific and objective. We have to look at this scientific and objective process within a backdrop of existing public policy discussion in the state of California. So we have to be able to balance all these factors in identifying what chemicals go into what lists.
We've got time for one more question. Well, I actually had a question. I just wondered, in your graphic, there's the sort of decision diamonds, I guess is what you're calling them, and from there is a category of chemicals with some information, and I was curious what happened when there was no information.
If there's no information, it really can't come into our prioritization process, because the first key issue is that red box, that hazard trait box. A chemical must exhibit one of those hazard traits to even be eligible to come into our prioritization process. But given what we know about the data gaps, about how little we know about most of the chemicals in the stream of commerce, we propose this multi-layered approach to be able to identify what chemicals are prioritized and kind of filling in the data gap, and what chemicals are real outliers out there in the sense that maybe they're present at such small amounts that, you know, we're not really interested in looking at them anytime soon. So we wanted to signal to academia, hey, or businesses, hey, that's not where we would say put your money in for research, put it into these other chemicals. So if it's got no information, it doesn't even come into this process.
Okay. Melissa, can I ask a quick question? This is Kathleen at Actio.
Please.
Oh, thanks. I was wondering about, we're a technology company. We make software that tracks substance-level data through a supply chain. And we've had some success with it so far, but it seems like there should be some kind of partnership between us and you. For example, how would you recommend we go about doing that?
You know, please give us a call. Send me an email. Set up a time. Let's talk about this. We've had other folks who do other what I call IT or logistics infrastructure issues in the supply chain arena come talk with us. It's very important for us to know what tools are out there so we don't reinvent the wheel.
Right.
In addition, you know, lessons learned about what works and what doesn't work. So we would love it if you could follow up. My email is Maziar, M-A-Z-I-A-R, as in Robert, at dtsc.ca.gov. Please send me an email. We'd love to set up a time. We can do it as a conference call, webinar, however way you want to do it, but if there are some tools out there, we'd love to know about it.
Yeah, that's what I think. Okay, it makes sense. Thank you. I will do.
Yeah, and I also encourage you, you know, on our website, there's the Green Chemistry Initiative Summary Report. That in that executive summary, there's more information about, for instance, the Toxic Information Clearinghouse and product ingredient disclosure issues. These, to me, all need an IT solution. And you know, who better to come up with it than the folks who are in that industry, because that's what, you know, the policymakers, we're missing that tool.
Yes, I agree. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Great. Well, we're just about at the hour, so I just wanted to thank you, Maziar, for your time today and for answering all of our questions. And thanks to everyone on the phone for their time as well.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.